To my immediate left, Joe Nocera, columnist for the New York Times and for Fortune magazine. To his left, Rajiv Chandrasekaran, who covered the trial for the Washington Post and went on to many other positions in the Post, spent a lot of time in Iraq, wrote a fabulous, fairly amazing book about Iraq and the Green Zone there, and is now national editor at the Washington Post. To his left, Mark Murray, who, as I said, was Microsoft's chief spokesperson during the trial and is now sort of chief of all things public relations and global relations for Microsoft. And finally, John Wilkie, one of the most dogged and persistent reporters during the trial and still, and doing great work at the Wall Street Journal. Gentlemen.
Hi, I'm Joe Nocera, and we do understand that when you have a panel of journalists, after economists, professors, lawyers, we're the entertainment. We get it. So we will try to make our remarks moderately brief, have a little more Q&A time, and all of us are going to make a few observations. We all have different. Rajiv really hasn't covered the trial or hasn't covered business since that trial. I cover business all the time, pretty much the same way I did. John Wilkie still writes about antitrust and still writes about Justice Department issues and still breaks news. And Mark Murray still says, picks up the phone and says, it's another great day for Microsoft. No. No, he doesn't. He really doesn't.
He took my talking point.
Right. So when Brad Smith was talking this morning, I just want to make three or four observations. When Brad Smith was talking this morning, I thought of another person that I wrote about a couple of years ago named Steve Parrish, who worked for Altria, the parent company of Philip Morris. And what brought it to mind was the idea that at that point in Microsoft's life, it was an incredibly insular place where people only talked to each other, and they viewed everybody on the outside as either idiots or enemies. And what happens when you have, and so when a company gets traumatized the way the tobacco industry was 10 years ago when it went through its travails in the mid-90s, and the way Microsoft was traumatized in the Microsoft trial, it forces companies to stop just talking to each other and to start, it forces them. They have no choice. They have to sit down and listen to other people. And they can't just talk at them. And one of the things I felt all during the Microsoft trial is that they would talk at them, at us, the press, but they would only really listen to each other. And that has changed. That is one thing that I think has profoundly changed at Microsoft, is that Brad said that the trial, he said at the cocktail party yesterday, that the trial taught Microsoft how to deal with the press, but I actually think it taught Microsoft how to deal with society and taught it to realize that just because you have a bunch of really smart engineers and a bunch of really smart business people, that doesn't mean you're right about every aspect of society, and it doesn't mean you have to maybe do things that give society more comfort. So that's point number one. Point number two, I think a lot now about what I really saw when I was there. And I actually think I've learned a lot today about that. Journalists need characters. And David was a great character. And the titan called Microsoft was another great character. And it really, the press, it was so easy for the press to characterize it as a fight between good and evil, or a fight between a guy who really knew how to kill these guys and another team that all they knew how to do was say, you know, hit me again, hit me again. That's what, and you'd have all these moments in the trial where David just, the person who asked about what are your most memorable moments, well, I think for us in the press, the most memorable moment was when Ed had discovered that the video of the Alchin screens had been, you know, basically done by the marketing department, and they weren't what they purported to be. And it was a day, it was as close to a Perry Mason moment as you're going to have in an antitrust trial. I mean, it's just like, how can this be happening? We wrote about it as drama. And I have thought a lot afterwards about, you know, what was real and what was not real, and what was show, and what was, you know, just pure theatrics. And I think a lot of what David said today spoke to that, about the issues of how it also becomes a morality play and how that factors in. My third comment of four, I will say, is that why in the world did the judge ever talk to the press? I will never understand this till it's inexplicable. I'd never covered a trial like this before. I hope John talks about this a little bit, because I just was stunned to discover afterwards that three sets of reporters were having back-channel conversations with Judge Jackson while this was going on. And then, of course, it all came out, and it certainly wasn't hardly the only or the most important reason the Court of Appeals removed him and slapped him around a little, but it's certainly one reason. Finally, see, I told you, we're going fast here. As somebody who's written a lot about internet and computing over the last decade, I am struck by how much of Microsoft's arguments, which we in the press did not take seriously at the time, have turned out to be true. One of the things they used to say was, you don't know where innovation is going to come from. And we would laugh. And they would say, there's this company called Red Hat that has this thing called Linux. It's going to be a threat. It's going to be a threat. And we would say, come on, get real. And you know, Google, you know, this is the 10th anniversary of Google. Google was founded when the Microsoft trial was going on. And who knew that that was going to be a great source of innovation and was going to diminish the importance and power of operating systems? We, you know, part of the problem of life, really, is that whatever cocoon you happen to be in, whatever era you happen to be in, whatever you have to see in front of you, whatever you see in front of you tends to be what you think will always be. And it's not. And, you know, I do think the trial changed the way Microsoft operates dramatically, and I think the trial also allowed a lot of competition. And I will end with this anecdote, which I think speaks to this a little bit. A couple of years ago, Bill Gates came to the New York Times, to the editorial bureau. And the publisher, Arthur Sulzberger, was there, and all the top editors were there, and I was, this is one of the few times they've ever let me in there. And you can see why they don't. And and somebody said to Gates, and it was very interesting. I mean, he was talking mostly about his foundation, but then he talked a little bit about business. And when he talked about business, boy, you could see he was comfortable with it in a way he wasn't in talking about his foundation. So there were laughter and jokes, and somebody said, so are you going to do to Google what you did to Netscape? And he said, nah, we'll find another way. Rajiv?
No, it's Wilkie.
John, you're next.
Okay. I first started becoming aware of Microsoft and its power, covering Lotus and Borland and some other companies that aren't around anymore in Boston. And I moved to Washington and started to become aware of this thing called the browser, which was being called the on-ramp or gateway to the internet. And I met as the preparations for the case started to wind up, Mark Andreessen, who invented it, or
that's what he would say.
And he said that Microsoft had tried to shut him down, had threatened them and told him that he could have part of the market, but that they'd take the rest. That was his claim. He said, I half expected to find a bloody computer monitor in my bed, and thus began the morality play. Somewhere along there, David Boies got hired as special counsel, and the trial began, and I think took on an extraordinary life of its own. Microsoft made, scored again and again, points that were being ignored. David and the government team kept coming back to credibility, And at the end of the day, when we all stood out on the courthouse steps, it seemed as if the government won the day over and over again. We ended up with a victory for the United States, upheld by a unanimous appeals court, a very conservative unanimous appeals court. A new administration came in, and I had an experience that I will, which that I'll never forget. After that new administration came in, I heard that Steve Ballmer was visiting Dick Cheney, and on in August of 2001. This was a secret meeting. It wasn't on his schedule. It wasn't on the vice president's schedule. It wasn't announced by Microsoft. A friend told me to be there at an appointed moment, and sure enough, there was Steve Ballmer walking out of the West Wing of the White House after having secretly met with Dick Cheney. At the time, we didn't know how powerful Cheney would become or was. And I have always wondered what happened in that meeting. I started working really hard on trying to figure out what this new administration would do with this case. And it took me a few weeks, but I had a story a few weeks later that said that Microsoft had entered secret settlement talks with the government, and the story was published on the morning of September 11th, and no one cared. Judge Kolar Kotelly very strangely said that it was some sort of patriotic urgency to settle the case now that the terrorists had attacked us somehow, and so the settlement emerged. At the time, it seemed to a lot of people commenting on the case and following it to be a slap on the wrist. I don't know what kind of effect. I'm not sure I can say what kind of effect it's had. But the marketplace certainly had its own effect, because just a few days ago, I saw a Microsoft call search the gateway to the internet, and the United States hired Sandy Litvak as special prosecutor in the Google case, in the Google matter, which may or may not be a case. So there's a weird symmetry there over these past 10 years, and I've always wondered what happened on that August day. We can come back in discussion about Sporkin and Jackson, and Joe, I'd like to answer your question when we okay. When we open up.
Well, we talk about unintended consequences. I never thought that all those months spent covering the Microsoft case would lead me to flee the country for multiple war zones, but so be it. This thing did all different things to different people. But it's a great honor to be here with both Joe and John. And I've got to say, when the history of this continues to be written, it's really their work in different ways that I think we will all continue to draw upon when it comes to looking at press accounts from this. John, just because of the scoops that he had in the lead up to the case being filed, during the case, and as recently as this past week, on an unrelated matter, but you know, just as the preeminent antitrust reporter in this country, and what Joe did that was such a stroke of genius was to write about this as a diarist, as a sort of a sketcher, and to tell a story, because this, you know, this was fundamentally a hell of a tale unfolding in a federal courtroom in Washington, D.C. With incredibly compelling characters on both sides, and an awful lot at stake. And there was the drumbeat of daily coverage that focused on as David mentioned earlier, often did focus on sort of the gotcha moment of the day. But when you go back and you read Joe's sketches or diary pieces for Fortune over the course of this, it is in some ways and it gets better with the passage of time. One of the best ways to sort of come back at this material, and it's not that many cases, let's even expand beyond cases of law, but that many sort of stories we in the press corps get to cover, where you might find yourself on a panel 10 years later with somebody you were sparring with over the phone day in, day out. And to just sort of see people on both sides of the case having come together, I think, really speaks to something very unique about this. And in our sort of very politically charged environment, not just in the world of Washington politics, but in so many things in this country today, to see that, people on both sides of this case can sort of come together 10 years later. But even during the trial, there was this sort of remarkable spirit of bonhomie that existed. In some ways, reminded me, and I don't mean to make too much light of this, of the old Warner Brothers cartoon where, the sheep and the wolf sort of clock in and they spend all day chasing each other, and then the whistle blows and they clock out. And, some of you may know, but on Thursday nights, we in the press corps, because we have a particular affinity for alcohol, would generally gather at a bar or a restaurant. It started out initially at the Capitol Grill, and then when we started to get called on our expense accounts, it sort of degenerated from there, went to some sort of low-grade steakhouse in D.C. We were invariably joined by folks on both sides. David would sometimes come, as well as other officials on the government side. Mark and his colleague Vivek Varma would be there, it was just, you don't see that these days in Washington, and even 10 years ago, it was remarkably rare. And I think it was just, for me, and I think for other colleagues in the press, what made this unique. A couple of other points. When I think back to the start of this, it's remarkable just how I think uninformed most of us in the press corps were. You had some reporters who were real specialists in the law and had covered antitrust issues. You had many other reporters who had come with some sort of technology background. And you had others who were just sort of general assignment court reporters. And everybody was sort of trying to bone up in their own way. I think it still speaks to the fact that many of us in the news business are fundamentally generalists, and there was an awful lot that was sort of transpiring on any given day that was sort of rightly going over our heads, and that sort of segues into the way the government put on its case, and not to be sort of duplicative of what David was saying earlier, and I obviously won't be as articulate as he was, but the way that the government framed its case gave us in many ways a very compelling narrative, and then those sorts of Perry Mason moments made for great stories. Got an antitrust trial on TV every now and again. I mean, go figure. And and that approach to not just sort of trying to play to sort of spin out this morality play before a judge, but also to the press, and that's what made this case in many ways something that editors allowed reporters to cover day in, day out. Yes, there was a degree of fundamental importance to this, but it was such a damn good story from the very beginning, from the clips of the videotaped depositions of Bill Gates on, that no editor in their right mind would have pulled a reporter from that courtroom. And it just speaks a lot to the way the government in this case particularly put on its case and how it sort of drove that narrative through. Thinking back to these sorts of specific moments, the Alchin video, the Gates deposition, and of course the emails. My memory is hazy on this particular point, but my most memorable moment, particularly in terms of David in the courtroom, was a case, and I can't sort of cite the specific witness, but the Microsoft witness had said something that seemed to be contrary to something that he had read in an email, and he just sort of standing back like a leopard waiting to pounce, sort of not even in the chair reserved for the government counsel, and whispered something to somebody on Phil's team, and you guys went through these boxes every day. You'd come in with these big banker's boxes with documents. You found the email, and there it was. And for those of us who are not experts in the law, sitting there in the gallery, it was these were the sorts of moments that kept us sort of coming back and writing about this case. In any event, I will stop blathering on and turn it over to Mark.
Well, it is really an honor to be sitting here with these guys. I mean, there's a special bond that you build, even if you are sort of working and arguing back and forth sometimes, and these guys are some of the most important figures in my professional life, so it's really great to be sitting here. And I want to thank Phil and the Berkman Center for inviting Microsoft to this and allowing us to participate. Several speakers have described how they came to the Microsoft case and had their lives changed, so I think I'll offer mine as well. It was August of 1996. I was 2 months at Microsoft, and I was on my honeymoon. And I was in a one-room bed and breakfast on a small island off the coast of Belize. And the woman that ran the bed and breakfast was a diehard Apple and Netscape fan. And I had made the mistake of offering, when she said, "So what do you guys do for a living? Blah, blah, blah. You're just newly married. How cute." I had mentioned that I worked for Microsoft. At 7 a.m. the next morning, she pounded on my door to let me know that the government had started issuing CIDs against Microsoft, and wasn't it great? And I looked at my wife and said, "This is not a good day for Microsoft." So, karma yesterday said that as she looks back, she thinks it's hard to say whether there were actually any winners or losers in the Microsoft trial. I have to say, when it comes to the press coverage, I think it's very clear that there were winners and losers in the Microsoft trial. I think that it's fair to say that my colleagues and I, that Microsoft was completely unprepared for the scale and the tenor of the coverage that was going to result from the case. And I think that part of it was, as David said, that we were arguing two different cases in the courtroom, and I think in many ways we were talking about two different cases with the media. And Microsoft was really focused on the technical aspects, the economic arguments. Was there or was there or not foreclosure? Did Netscape have mechanisms to deliver its browser to people or not? And in a way, that quickly became beside the point, and I think we didn't realize that quickly enough. It was a little ironic this morning to hear Frank Fisher say that he thought that Microsoft's legal team was playing to the court of public opinion a little too much in its legal strategy, without giving away any family secrets or airing out family laundry within the Microsoft camp. I can tell you that despite my frequent begging, that was the furthest thing from our lawyer's mind of playing to the court of public opinion. My view is that the two sides had pretty different philosophies about how legal and communication strategies fit together, and that the government really saw the connection between the legal arguments that they were trying to make and the arguments that would play in the court of opinion, public opinion. And that, you know, Microsoft really took the position that the audience that we were playing to in the courtroom was an audience of one, and that the PR people were free to run around and try to put the best spin that we could put on it, but that there was not an integration in the same way that there was with the government. I think there's a universal... What's that?
Or the browser.
Yeah. I think there's a universal truth that whenever two sides are in sort of a dispute, that each of them is going to think that the other side is doing more to try to leverage the situation and that each of them is getting a better ride from the media. And I think that probably did occur on both sides. It's interesting to talk at this conference with folks who are on the other side and hear from their perspective how they felt things that were going and where they felt that we had gotten a good ride from the media. I mean, clearly, there were some unique factors in this case. The fact that there was no direct testimony at all and that it was just cross-examination, then a small amount of redirect, really changed, you know, how evidence was brought out in the case. And I remember after we broke and we were back in Redmond, it was holiday time, and you know, clearly the first two or three months of the case had not gone very well, and the press coverage had been pretty bad. And one of our executives said, "Yeah, but we haven't had a chance to get our witnesses on yet, and then we're really going to rock." And we just thought, yeah, it's going to be nonstop cross-examination from David Boies. That's going to be great. And another unique factor of the case was obviously the Gates deposition. And, you know, Karma, it was great to hear yesterday Karma say, "I can't believe that we got away with playing it day after day after day." You know, there's another interesting factor that, you know, when the deposition was being taken, there was actually an order in place from the court saying that no videotaped depositions would be played in court. And after the deposition was taken, you know, that order was modified, and, you know, videotaped depositions were allowed to come into the court. And so I think that had a pretty profound effect on trial strategy and, you know, the ability to really move this into a morality play and not just, you know, economic issues and arguments among dry economists. Our corporate communications tactics changed pretty radically over the course of the 6 months. I think we arrived, we were going to be very proactive, we were going to make sure that, you know, we drove the narrative of this case. That was our, you know, Microsoft likes to do version 1, version 2, version 3. That was our version 1.0 strategy, is we were going to be very proactive. It quickly morphed into version 1.1, which is we were going to be very proactive, and we were just going to try, you know, hope like hell that we got at least any message into the coverage. Version 2.0 was we decided we're going to be very reactive. You know, we'd go out and talk on the courthouse steps if David was going to go out and talk on the courthouse steps, and we sort of take our lead from the government. Version 3.0 is we had this blinding realization that the reporters had actually sat in the same courtroom that we had sat in. They didn't actually need us to go out on the courthouse steps and tell them what they had just seen. And in fact, it kind of irritated them when we tried to tell them what they had just seen. So, you know, it doesn't take very long, but we wised up to it, and so we decided that we would just sort of, you know, head on back to our law offices or our hotel rooms, or maybe even just get a good run in, and that was probably the most productive thing we could do in working with the media. And if they called us, we'd probably take the call. Brad talked a little bit about how, you know, Microsoft has changed and how the trial changed Microsoft. And Dave talked about how, you know, the trial changed how we build our products. I would also say that the trial and the experience we went through, you know, has had a pretty profound effect on how we handle corporate communications at Microsoft as well. Before I joined Microsoft, I spent 15 years in government, both in Washington, D.C. and in the, you know, communications director for the mayor of Seattle. So I was used to some pretty intense partisan back and forth. I had had protesters chain themselves to my desk in Seattle. But nothing prepared me for what I saw when I joined Microsoft, just the amount of adolescent bickering within the software industry. And John, you covered the industry. I mean, every day it seemed like Scott McNeely would wheel out a new, you know, insult for, I mean, he called Gates and Ballmer, Ballmer and Butthead. He talked about Windows as a hairball. You know, it's just the level of playground taunting surprised even me coming from government. And I think we, you know, and let's just be honest, you know, Microsoft loved to give it right back. You know, we're talking about the mid-90s. It was a pretty rough and tumble industry, and we loved sort of jabbing each other. And I think we brought a little bit of that to the trial when we first started, that we thought we were still in a fairly aggressive communications mode. And, you know, over time, I think that we really have learned from the case, and that the learnings that we had in Washington, D.C. were carried back to Washington State. And the folks who had been on the front lines in the trial were accorded a certain amount of respect and influence in moderating the more aggressive impulses of our communications team in Redmond. And I think we now take a much more long-term approach to our communications. I think we now don't think that, you know, our job is to sort of ram our message down the throats of reporters. It's much more to have a conversation that extends over months and over many news cycles and understand where people are coming from and, you know, understand the dynamics of the industry as a whole and try to have a mature conversation and persuade people to our point of view rather than try to, you know, bully people to our point of view. And the last thing is, I think that the trial has definitely caused Microsoft to have a very thick skin when it comes to PR. There are people that join my team from other companies, and they're inevitably, I mean, the scene repeats itself with every new person. You know, at some point in the first month, they will show up at my door, you know, breathless and say, "Oh my God, you know, look at what's happening here. Look at this news story." And I'll look at it and I'll say, "Yeah, that's not a great story. But you know what? We've seen worse. We're going to make it through this." You know, don't get so excited. So I think it's good for corporations to have thick skins. I think it's good for corporations to understand how they fit into society and where they stand vis-a-vis the needs of citizens and the role that government plays. And I think that Microsoft, there might have been easier ways to learn it, but we learned it.
So, in the interest of keeping things moving, we're going to probably just only go for another 10 or 15 minutes, but and we'll open it up to questions. But I did want to ask Mark one question first, which is, if you had done a better job with the audience of one, Judge Jackson, in other words, you know, if the judge had been more receptive to your witnesses and the arguments in the court, and ultimately he was the person deciding the case, would the audience of journalists and newspaper stories and magazine articles have mattered? In other words, you know, we were doing it for our readers. I mean, that was our purpose. But, you know, how much did the press actually matter in the context of this trial?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would actually, I'll answer that question and also turn it around a little bit, which is we came to realize that what really mattered in the coverage was how the respective sides did with the audience of one. That, you know, you guys were writing what you saw. And the most important things that you saw was how the judge responded.
Right.
And so if Microsoft had, you know, gotten a more positive response or a more positive hearing or the body language or the questions posed from the bench had been more positive, I think that the coverage would have been more positive. The other question you ask is, you know, did the coverage matter? Did the coverage in any way affect the outcome I mean, I don't think I'm the best person to ask that of. My strong sense is that the coverage probably did not have a significant outcome or impact on the outcome of the case. I think it had a significant outcome or impact on the outcome of, you know, how people perceive, you know, what went on in the trial, how people perceived Microsoft to some degree. And so I think that the coverage was important, but I don't think in my heart that it was important to the specific outcome of the case.
Yes, sir.
A question for Mark, maybe two questions. A day or two after the European Commission handed down its big decision in its Microsoft case.
The Commission or the Court of First Instance?
The Commission.
Okay.
Three United States senators, John Warner was one, gave speeches from the floor condemning the Europeans for meddling in the in affairs that had already been taken care of in the United States. And what's interesting about those speeches is that they were all almost identical, verbatim. Now, I don't think the three senators got together and said, let's all give the same speech. And in fact, they cleaned up their error later, and only one appeared in the congressional record. I got this from the raw transcript. Now, what was going on there? question number two, a broader question. I don't have the numbers in my head, but when the Microsoft case was escalated in 1998, there was a tremendous increase, several millions of dollars, in Microsoft's Washington lobbying expenditures, and also a large increase in its political contributions. What effect, if any, did you think those contributions had?
Boy, this brings you back, doesn't it, Mark?
I may tell the story that I left out after all. So let me take the second question first, which is, you know, sort of looking at the growth of Microsoft's Washington, D.C. operations and our lobbying. And I'm certainly not the most expert at that. We've got several people here from our law and corporate affairs that I can refer you to as well. But I would take it back even a little bit further than that. In the early 1990s, all the way to like 1993, 1994, we had no one in Washington, D.C. And then in about 1994, 1995, we had a one-person office in Washington, D.C. And the rest of the technology industry was probably in about the same boat, you know, that this is an industry that grew up on the left coast and, you know, basically viewed itself as innovators, you know, working, you know, in a very, you know, entrepreneurial way, and that government really didn't have a role in the work that was being done. So the entire industry was rather slow to ramp up, I think, in terms of their Washington, D.C. presence. And over time, I think we came to realize that the issues that we're talking about, technology came to play such a role in the life of individuals, in the life of businesses, and the life of American society, that government had a legitimate role in, you know, regulating it and looking at it and you know, looking at policies that would affect it, and that, you know, the industry had to step up. And so I would not draw a line between that and, you know, this specific case. I think you need to look at the bigger issues that are going on. Now, for some reason, and I'm excited to hear about why, when you asked your first question, Mr. Boyce put his hand up as though he wanted to answer it. I'm almost afraid of what I'm about to hear. I'm not sure what I'm about to hear. It reminds me of my favorite moment of the trial when I can't remember which witness it was who said, I think that's a trick question, and then you said, no, I will raise my hand when I'm asking you a trick question. So, and then about 10 minutes later, you asked a question with your hand raised. So should I be calling on you or should I not?
One of the things that I thought was interesting in comparison to the IBM case is that after the IBM case was over, the EU went after IBM. And the Justice Department was extremely helpful in helping to keep what the EU did in within some reasonable bounds. And I think for some of the reasons we talked about at lunch, the Justice Department and the United States government generally, whether they're senators or the executive branch, has been a lot less successful and a lot less able to play a meaningful role in influencing what happened in the EU. And it may be that a new administration will be more effective in that. But I think one of the consequences of a whole series of actions, beginning with maybe the settlement, but including things as disparate as the Iraq War and the effect on European countries, is that our administration has not had the ability to make the kind of impact that otherwise might have happened. I had one comment on Joe's question. Lots of judges talk to the press, and including during trials. They are almost invariably sophisticated enough in doing that to keep the ground rules very clear that it is totally not for attribution at any time, not just until the trial is over. And I think that the thing, not every judge talks to the press, and I think it's a minority, but it's a very substantial minority. And I think the thing that distinguished Judge Jackson was not that he talked to the press, but a certain naivete in the sense of not understanding how explosive it was if it was going to get out, and his sort of attitude of, well, I don't want you to print it while I'm deciding the case, but once it's over with, you can print it. And I think that was the issue. In my mind, it wasn't that unusual for somebody to talk to the press. It was unusual.
Well, I'm glad to know that for the Google trial.
Yeah.
Judge Jackson, when I spoke to him, made it clear that he was talking to me and evidently to a couple of others only after all the facts were in and the record was closed. He said that Microsoft has hundreds of people and teams of lawyers, and I'm here alone. And he wanted to be able to explain why he did what he did. And he did ask people to, the reporters he spoke to keep it off the record. The fact that he'd done so before deciding the case, again, after all the facts were in, which he thought, he said, it's my job to have an opinion, and I do have an opinion, and here it is. And the New York Times did not respect that wish when they published their story a day after ours. That's what happened.
Wait. wait a minute. The way it works is you're the first person who got Jackson on the record, and they did it the next day, and then we're the bad guys here?
What happened was the Times story made it clear that the judge had talked, you know, prior to the closing of the...
Oh, I see. We only have 5 more minutes. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry, this is another question for Mark, but I wanted to ask you about the Freedom to Innovate Network. I guess the grassroots organization, some might dare to call it AstroTurf, advocacy organization that got set up during the trial. I was wondering if you got any mileage out of that in terms of let's say, Tunney Act comments, and you know, what you see the role for the organization going forward vis-a-vis in relation to the press activities.
Sure.
I don't have any insight into whether or not companies that joined the Freedom to Innovate Network helped to provide some of the 32,000 comments that Phil had to read or not. But basically, that is a voluntary organization of people who, you know, of companies that sign up and say, yes, we believe that, you know, allowing high-tech companies to continue to be able to innovate and integrate new features into their products, that's an important consideration for ongoing economic growth. So, Phil, to the extent that they did, you know, make it a more heavy reading cycle, you know, our apologies on their behalf.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We're only, gosh.
Back on track.
We're only 15 minutes behind schedule.
Very well done. Thank you all very much.